Okay, let's start out with our motivation. Let's begin with some humility and recognizing that our view of the world is erroneous, and that that is the source of all of our difficulties and problems. And that our view is so ignorant and so habituated in our mind that we don't even recognize it's there, let alone recognize that it misapprehends things. So with that kind of humility, let's then approach the Buddha's teachings and to learn how it's possible for things to exist and how it's impossible for them to exist. And to think about these teachings, ascertain them ourselves through reasoning, which is reliable, and in this way to clear the dust of ignorance from our eyes of wisdom, so that we can clearly see how people and phenomena exist. And by apprehending them correctly, then to work for the benefit of sentient beings and lead them also to the state of freedom by helping them to overcome their ignorant views as well. So let's keep that as our motivation today. Okay, so we've been in chapter 13, right? So last week we were talking about, like in a visual perception, who is the one that looks, you know? Like, what's the agent that looks at something and that perceives something? So we decided that consciousness can't be the one who looks, because if consciousness looked at the object before it perceived it, that's not possible. Yeah, because you can't look at something before you perceive it. If the consciousness looked at the object after it perceived it, then that's useless, because it's already perceived the object. And if we think that what looks and the consciousness are simultaneous, that also doesn't work, because then what looks at the object can't be the cause for the perception of the object. Okay, so we're speaking here like if things existed by their own entity, you would have to be able to isolate exactly who was the looker and how each of the components, you know, produced a consciousness. So, but we can't do that, so that goes to refute inherent existence. If we talk just about dependent conventional existence, there's no such requirement that you have to be able to draw your line around whatever is doing the action or whatever a thing is, because you're realizing that it's something that exists merely by being labeled and conceived. Okay? Then we talked about if the eye is the agent that looks. Okay? And then that doesn't work either, because if the eye organ, the eye sense power, has to travel to the object to see it, then how does it know, if it hasn't seen the object, how does it know what object to travel to? Mm-hmm. So that doesn't work. Okay. also, if it didn't travel to the object, then it should see everything very, very clearly, because everything would appear to it. But that's not the case either, because things far away are much more, you know, fuzzy. Okay, so that one doesn't work. Okay. And then we talked about if the nature of the eye organ itself, the eye sense power, were to perceive, then it the first thing it should perceive would be itself, because it's right there with itself. But our eye can't see itself. The retina can't see itself. Okay. That doesn't work. Okay. So, and then we thought, well, maybe the object is what sees, what looks at the object, you know. But the object isn't consciousness, and it's not a sense power, and it's inanimate, so it can't look at anything. So there you have the three things that are usually said to be the cause of the perception: the object, the sense power, and then the consciousness. Usually the cause is the immediately preceding moment of consciousness. And you can't find any of those really, you know, isolate them as the thing that is the agent. Then we talked a little bit about sound. Okay, and if does sound make a noise as it's traveling to our ear? Okay, because if it makes a noise as it's traveling to our ear, then what? Then we don't. It's already sound, you know, and we already hear it because we already know it's making. It's making noise as it's traveling. Okay, so then it's already sound. If it doesn't make any noise, if it's silent as the sound wave is traveling to us, then it's not sound because it's not an object perceivable by the ear consciousness. And also, if it's something that's silent, then how can it later become something that makes noise? Okay, so when you ring the gong far away and the sound waves are traveling here, yeah, if it's already sound and it makes noise, then we would already hear it before the sound waves hit our ears. If it is silent when it's traveling here, then it's not noise, and how can it become noise, or how can it become sound? Okay. Because it's still out there, it hasn't reached our ear yet. Okay, so, so verse 220 says, when sound is not heard, it is not sound, because it's not yet the object of ear consciousness, existing from its own side, okay?
What number
are you? 320. 320, yeah. And it is impossible for that which is not sound to finally turn into sound and be something that's heard. Okay? And so then we had the analogy of like the guitar or the flute or whatever, yeah? So you have the instrument, you have the strings or the reeds or whatever it is, you have the person who plays it, but where is the sound? What is it that makes the sound? Yeah, the person doesn't make the sound. The wood of the guitar doesn't make the sound. The strings alone don't make the sound. Yeah, you have to have all of those things together in a dependently existent arrangement for sound to be produced. But none of the things by themselves produce sound. So it seems kind of almost like magic that sound is produced, because when you look at the instrument, you can't find the sound and you can't find the thing that makes the sound. You know? Because again, if the player of the sound, the music maker, were inherently existent, you should be able to find exactly what it is. Okay? So then there's the idea in verse 321 that maybe the mental consciousness perceives the sense objects. Okay, so the verse says, without the sense organs, what will mind do after it has gone? If it were not so, why would that which lives not always be without mind? Okay, so Job Lowe here says, the mind apprehends objects after traveling to them. Okay, so if we start out with like the auditory consciousness, yeah, it doesn't go to the object along with the ear organ. Yeah, you know, when the airplane's flying above, my consciousness and my ear organ don't go up there to apprehend it. Okay, the organs always remain in the body, you know, in the body. Okay, even if the mind could approach its object without the sense organs, how could it look and listen? Because, like a blind person, it would lack the ability to see the object. So even if the consciousness could go to the object without the sense faculty going there, how could it know what object to go to, because there's no sense faculty kind of directing it? It's really like the blind leading the blind. Okay? And so then it says, you know, in the last two lines, if it were so, why would that which lives not always be without mind? So that which lives means the self, the person. So why wouldn't that always be without mind? And that's not so clear to me, but what it seems to me it means is, if the mind could perceive without sense organs, then couldn't the self also perceive without the sense faculties? Okay. And then, in that case, the self and the mind would be inherently different. You know, so the mind could see without saying, I saw, or if the self saw, it wouldn't need the mind to see. You know, in other words, it's... if you just had the self, if the self could perceive without consciousness, I mean, that would be pretty weird. Because then the self would be without mind, wouldn't it? You would have a self without mind. And this is one of the whole things, you know, why you can't say the mind is the person or I am my consciousness. Because if I and consciousness did the same thing, then it's redundant, you know. If you have an I, a person, and a consciousness that perform the exact same functions, then you really don't need one of them. Yeah. So then you could be able to have the person without having the person's mind, because the person could do everything the mind did. Or you could have the mind without there being a person who owned the mind, because the person could do everything that, I mean, the mind could do everything that the person did. But that doesn't work, does it? You know, the person can't be the mind, and the mind can't be the person. Because if it were, then, you know, when you said, I'm walking, if the person were the mind, you could eat just, it would mean the mind is walking, but your mind doesn't walk. Okay? So, the conclusion here is, when you investigate with reasoning, neither the sense powers nor the consciousnesses have, by their own power, the ability to apprehend objects. Okay? So this goes against our usual way of thinking of our mind and the object and the sense power. Because we usually think, here's my visual consciousness. There's already a visual consciousness there, right? And it's just waiting for an object to come along and see. But it's already a visual consciousness. But what's the definition of a visual consciousness? That which perceives color and shape. Now, if that consciousness is not perceiving color and shape, at that moment, like your eyes are closed, can you say it's a visual consciousness? No. So you can't have a visual consciousness that exists from its own side that's not perceiving an object, that's just sitting there waiting for an object to see. Okay? And similarly, we usually think that the object is out there. There's an objective object, you know, that has color and shape and all those characteristics out there. And it's just waiting for me to come along and see it. Yeah. But again, to be a visual object, it has to be perceivable. If it's inherently existent as a visible object, then a consciousness has to be perceiving it at that very moment. Yeah. And that doesn't work either. Because if it has its own, if it exists by its own entity as an object of visual consciousness, okay, by its own entity means it doesn't depend on any other factors to be an object of visual consciousness, which means it doesn't depend on the visual consciousness or the eye organ or anything else for it to be a visible object. So that means it would be a visible object even if there were no visual consciousness or eye sense power. Okay, that's not true. Okay, so remember here we're talking about things that exist from their own side. Yeah. And similarly, we think of our eye sense power, you know, and the retina, as it is, it too is an inherently existent sense power, you know. It's just an eye sense power. Hi, I'm an eye sense power. And it's just waiting for an object to come along and for the consciousness to wake up so it can put the two things together. Yeah? But again, it can't exist in that way. Because to be an eye sense power, it depends on there being such things as visual objects and visual consciousness. Okay? So you see, when things are inherently existent, these things have to be able to perform their own functions without depending on any other thing. So the consciousness should be able to see an object without depending on an object, because it has its own entity as a visual consciousness. And so what you begin to see here is that nothing exists or can it perform its own function independent of everything else. To have a visual consciousness, you need an object that can be seen, and you need the sense power, okay? And that all three of those exist dependent on each other, and they're not all sitting out there, each with their own inherent nature, waiting to collide in space, yeah? That they exist dependent on one another. Okay, it's the same way, like, you know, when we give names to people's roles in a family. You can't have a parent unless there's a child. You can't have a child unless there's a parent. They exist in relationship to each other. It's not that somebody's a parent and then by their own nature, and then 10 years later along comes a child. Yeah. Or it's not that somebody's a child without there ever being a parent. That can't happen either. Okay? So these things always exist in relationship to each other. Okay? Similarly, brothers and sisters or grandparents or whatever the relationships are, these all have to depend on other people and on, you know, the whole way these relationships are constructed. They don't exist that way from their own side. Okay? Even we say telephone, you know, we look at this thing and we say telephone. Yeah. This thing could not be a telephone if human beings didn't exist. It's not a telephone in and of itself, because the function of a telephone is to be able to transmit messages between living beings, you know, who know how to use it. If there were no human beings, that this thing could not perform that function, and it would not be a telephone. Yeah? Okay. If it inherently existed as a telephone, if it didn't inherently exist as a telephone, even if there were no human beings, we could still designate it as a telephone, because once upon a time, in relationship to human beings, it did perform that function. Okay. So in independently arising things, where things exist only by being labeled, that's possible. But with inherent existence, there has to be the actual objects here and now. But then, if it depended, you know, if it had actual people here and now to be a telephone, then it wouldn't be an inherently existent telephone, because it depended on the people, you know, who made it and who had a function for it. Okay? So it's quite interesting to think about this. Yeah? So remember when you were a kid, you know, if the tree falls in the forest, nobody's out there, is there a sound? Okay? So there's clearly, there can't be an inherently existent sound, because if there were, there would have to be somebody there hearing it. Okay? But we could say that if it's just a dependently arising sound and it is perceivable by mind, yeah, then it could be called a sound. Yeah. Because if there were a mind there, it could be heard. It could be designated as a sound. Because it's not a sound from its own side. It's only called a sound in relationship to a consciousness. Okay? So it isn't required to have that essence of being perceived by a consciousness, you know, at that moment. Okay? It's perceivable by consciousness, but that means it's dependent on consciousness. So that's okay. Okay? So then, verse 222. An object already seen is perceived by mind like a mirage. That which posits all phenomena is called the aggregate of recognition or discrimination. Okay, so here again we're refuting the true existence of that which perceives the objects. So first of all, we're defining the aggregate of recognition. So Joe Blow says, if the sense organs and their objects do not inherently exist, the aggregate of discrimination that discerns what is exclusive to them would be non-existent. In other words, if the sense organs and their objects, objects of sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, mental objects, if they didn't have their own nature, then the aggregate of recognition could not recognize them. Or the aggregate of discrimination could not discriminate that they are that object and not something else. Because Joe Blow is thinking, if they don't have, you know, if they don't exist inherently, then they're non-existent. Okay? And, you know, because if they don't exist inherently, if they don't have their own nature, and they don't have, you know, have certain characteristics that are their characteristics by their own nature, then what is discrimination or recognition going to discriminate or recognize? Yeah? Because you can't discern an object that doesn't have any characteristics by its own nature, from its own side. Okay? So, like, if this didn't have any color and it didn't have any shape from its own side, independent of everything else, then Joe Blow is saying, how could you perceive it? Okay? And that's kind of the way we see it, isn't it? It's like, yeah, this is pink and white and, you know, a little bit of pale green from its own side. And because it has these colors that are its characteristics in it. Therefore, my consciousness can come along and see it, and my, you know, that mental factor of recognition or discrimination can say, oh yes, this is the top of the cup, because it seems to have these characteristics as an inherent part of it. Yeah. But are the color and shape of the object inherently existent characteristics of this? Kind of seems like they should be, because if they aren't there, how are you going to recognize it? How are you going to say it is what it is? It should have these characteristics from its own side, shouldn't it? Yeah? Yeah? I mean, if this robe weren't yellow from its own side when I was looking for my chugu, how would I possibly recognize it? It must be yellow from its own side. Seems like that, doesn't it? Yeah? Joblo's question is not so stupid. If you look at our regular way of perceiving. Okay, so what's wrong with that?
Yeah.
Yeah. What's wrong with it? Let's hear it for Joe Blow, you know?
He's smarter
than
this
type. Yeah, he is. Joe Blow's not such a dum-dum. Huh?
Your parents will always look that way, except for to a Buddha or somebody who's in meditative
acupuncture. Yeah.
Parents will always look that way.
Yeah.
The only way you can get out of it is reason.
Yeah, but when you're an Arya, after you've realized emptiness directly, you recognize the false perception. So you don't buy into it. Okay? But we buy into it. You know, yeah, of course, it's got to have that, those characteristics from its own side. Okay, so Aryadeva says, though the sense faculties and their objects don't exist when analyzed by reasoning. Okay, so he means they don't exist inherently when analyzed by reasoning. They aren't non-existent conventionally, because mental consciousness apprehends the exclusive aspects of an object, such as visible form, that has already been perceived. Okay, for example, though a mirage does not contain any water, a discrimination of water occurs. Okay, so if you think of an example of a mirage, there's no water there. Yet, the mental consciousness just still discriminates water. It says water's there. So in the same way, yeah, there's no cup top from its own side that inherently has these colors, yeah, but there's still an appearance. So what it's getting at is things, even though things do not exist inherently, they still can function on the level of appearances. That's the point, yeah. Because it seems to us that if they don't exist inherently, then they don't exist at all. Yeah. If there's no truly existent top that truly existently possesses these colors and shapes, then there's nothing here. What kind of top could there ever be if it isn't what I'm perceiving with my senses? Yeah? But if what I'm perceiving by my with my senses existed the way it appears to me, then it would be able to be perceived without any consciousness looking at it, and without any sense faculty, you know, acting as the intermediary to link it up with a consciousness.
Without a label.
Yeah, well, I'm not even, forget label, you know, we're just talking raw sense data, not even labels at this point, okay? So the point is, that which perceives the exclusive aspects of an object, okay, which is a mental factor positing the exclusive signs of all phenomena, is called the aggregate of discrimination or recognition. Okay? And the phenomena posited by discrimination don't exist from their own side. So discrimination can posit things. It can say, oh, there's a top, there's a clock, there's a computer. Okay? And the mental consciousness can apprehend these things without any of these things having an inherent nature. Okay? Because we discriminate them in relationship to other phenomena and in relationship to their attributes. Okay? So this is not a cup top from its own side. It exists as a cup top in relationship to this. Okay? If this weren't here, yeah, then you couldn't, if there were no, were never any such thing as a cup, you could not posit a cup top. Okay? So that this thing exists dependently. If there were not these colors and shapes, you could not see the object. But that doesn't mean that the object is the color and shape. Okay. We may say, oh, this is yellow. This is actually the first debate you ever do when you're learning to bait. A white horse is not white. Okay? Why? Because white is a color and a horse is not a color. Okay, so white horse is not white. Yeah. So it makes you think, you know, what does the word is mean? Okay. Yeah, they get you all tangled up like, well, what color is ours? It's white. So the white horse is white. So the white horse is a color. So you're riding a color. No, it's not a color. Oh, then the white horse isn't white. It's purple. It's not white. Okay? Okay. So our point here is that objects can still be discriminated and as being what they are, but they can be discriminated actually. They can still be discriminated without their having an inherent nature. And in fact, it's because they don't have an inherent nature that you can recognize and discriminate them. Because if they had an inherent nature, yeah, then they would be what they were from their own side, and they could never ever change. Yeah. So you could, you know, this would never break. And actually, then you would never have the clay before that became this. Because the clay would have the inherent nature of clay, and it could never change to become a top. Yeah. Because when you look at clay, it looks like there's clay, right? Inside of it, there's clay. But if that were clay inside of it, then how come you can do something and then all of a sudden it's no longer clay? Then clay becomes not clay. Clay becomes a cup top. But when you look at it and it's clay, I mean, you're sure it's clay. All through the entire substance, every molecule of it is clay. But if that were true, then it could never change into any other substance whatsoever. Everything would be frozen if it had an inherent nature. Okay? Tolius was talking about this when we were in New York, and he was saying because things are empty, then they have a dependent nature, and causes can produce effects. and things can interact with each other to produce new things. If they didn't have, if they weren't empty, if they had an inherent nature, they would not have a dependent nature. And that would mean they could not interact and affect each other. Because everything would be what it was in and of itself without depending on anything else. Yeah. But, you know, when we look at each other, and we, you know, we say there's Samten and there's Alexis. It looks like, you know, Samten's there in and of herself. Alexis is there in and of herself. Karuna, in and of herself. You know, it looks like quite distinct people. Yeah, that exist independent of anything else. But if Karuna, we're talking about you. If Karuna existed inherently as Karuna, then Karuna never could have been born. Because there would be no necessity for her to be born, because Karuna exists without depending on any causes. And then Karuna would never get old. And then Karuna could never live up to her name of compassion. But she's changing. Yeah? Slowly. Yeah. Okay. So it's because things are empty that then they can function and change. Yeah. So as Holiness in New York was saying, when you really understand this, then you can understand how, as ignorant beings, we can become Buddhas. Because it's possible to change. Because we have a dependent nature. Okay, 323. In dependence upon the I and form, this is the I, mind arises like an illusion. It is not reasonable to call illusory that which has existence. So here we're refuting its true existence. So Joe Blow says, if the aggregate of discrimination doesn't exist inherently, it would be impossible to posit phenomena. Because you have to have one mental factor whose job it is to recognize and discern phenomena and give them labels. And it has to have that ability to do that function in and of itself. And if there's no mental factor that has that inherent function, then it's impossible to posit phenomena or to recognize phenomena. Arya Deva says, no problem. Even though it doesn't exist by its own side or by its own entity, the mind arises like a magical illusion in dependence upon the eye or the eye faculty and visible form. Okay, so although you can't find which mind, you know, and isolate exactly the mental factor separate from the mind that apprehends the object, when all these factors come together, cognition occurs. Although you can't find any one thing that makes it happen, or any one isolated thing that does the cognizing. So cognition is dependent on many factors. Okay? So anything that exists with its own entity can't be called illusory because it's its own entity. You know, it has its own entity. But we say all these things are like illusions because they appear to have their own entity, but they don't because they exist dependent on other things. Okay? 324. When there is nothing on earth that does not amaze the wise, why think cognition by the senses and such like are amazing? Okay, so this verse is showing that the lack of true existence is like magic, a cause for amazement. Okay, so Joe Blow says, it's amazing to claim that the sense organs in no way whatsoever can apprehend objects, and that visual consciousness arises in dependence on the eye in the visible form. So Joe Blow's thoroughly confused, you know, because we couldn't isolate the sense organ that apprehends the object. So he says, you're claiming that the sense organs can't in no way whatsoever can apprehend objects. And then you're also saying that the visual consciousness arises in dependence on the eye sense organ in the visible form. Okay? So he's back stuck in this thing about there should be something there waiting to perceive the form. Okay. So Aryadeva says, look, you know, the fact that that happens, that cognition occurs, isn't the cause for amazement. When analyzed by reasoning, a sprout and so forth, neither it comes into existence from a seed that has ceased, nor from one that hasn't ceased. Okay, so you have a sprout. The sprout does not grow from a seed that has ceased, because if the seed has already ceased, it can't be the cause for the sprout. And it also can't grow from a seed that hasn't ceased, because if the seed is still there, then, and the sprout grows from it, then you have the cause and effect existing at the same time. How are you going to solve that one? What seed does the sprout grow from? Yeah, because if the seed has already ceased, the sprout can't grow from it. If it hasn't ceased, the sprout also can't grow from it. Okay, but the sprouts arise in dependence on the seeds. So for the wise, there's nothing that is not as amazing as magic. So why should we think that cognitions of objects by sense consciousnesses that don't truly exist are amazing? Because that applies to everything, you know, that you can, that everything, the fact that things don't inherently exist is not such an amazing thing, because that applies to everything. Because if they inherently existed, they couldn't function at all. Okay? So when they talk about the seed producing the sprout, okay, the seed that is in the process of ceasing and the sprout that is in the process of arising exist at the same time. Now, what is the sprout that is in the process of arising? If it's a truly existent sprout, then it can't be in the process of arising, because it would already be a sprout. So when we say the sprout that is in the process of arising, is the sprout that is in the process of arising a sprout? No. Is a future sprout a sprout? No.
Not an object.
It is an object.
A future sprout?
Yeah, it's an object. Object is synonymous with existent. A future sprout exists, but a future sprout is not a sprout. And the sprout that is arising is not a sprout. Okay. The seed that is ceasing is a seed. The seed that is in the process of ceasing exists now. And it exists at the same time as the sprout that is in the process of arising. Except that sprout in the process of arising is not a sprout, because it hasn't attained its own entity. So why do we call it a sprout if it's not a sprout? Okay.
Habits.
Because, you know, we're thinking if things that are inherently existent, if we say something's a sprout, it needs to be a sprout at that very moment. In the case of inherently existing things. But in the case of things that aren't inherently existent, there's no need for that label to fit on, to be the object at that time. Okay? Like when you plant a seed, you say, I'm planting a tree. There's no tree there. Does there need to be a tree there for you to say, I'm planting a tree? If things inherently exist, there better be a tree there. But we can say, I'm planting a tree, if there's no inherent existence, because we're just using words to convey some meaning that we all understand. And there's no necessity that we draw a line around exactly what it is that that word refers to. Okay, but with inherently existent things, you have to be able to draw a line around it. It's similar, like if you look at our town, our local town, there's Newport. Yeah? Where's Newport? There's Newport. But if you ask, what really is Newport? What does the word Newport refer to? Yeah? Well, it got its name because it was a new port. And because the railroad, they used to have the railroad take all the logs down, and the railroad, no, they used to float the rock.
The logs down the river.
Yeah. No, the railroad used to take it, didn't it? And then the port got built to float it. To float the logs?
Or vice versa.
Or vice versa. It's called Old Town because whatever was there before got old because Newport was now there. Mm-hmm. Because Newport, I think the Newport could function to...
Better than the Old Town.
Yeah, better than Old Town. But see, Old Town wasn't always Old Town. Yeah, it was once New Town. Yeah, and Newport wasn't Newport because it wasn't a port, you know, 200 years ago. Anyway, what exactly is Newport? You know, is it the earth? Is it the buildings? Is it the people? Is it the town hall with the certificate that it's an incorporated town? What, you know, when we ask, exactly what is Newport? What are we referring to when we say, I'm going to Newport? Yeah, what really are you referring to? Are you going to some dirt? Are you going to some bricks? Are you going to some people? Are you going to a piece of paper? Yeah, when you analyze to find out exactly what Newport is, to see if it existed inherently, because if it existed inherently, you would be able to find it. Yeah. But when we search for what it is, we can't find it, so it doesn't exist inherently. But it does exist, how? By mere designation. And the mere designation is just, you know, we all agreed to call that Newport, and somehow, even though we don't know what Newport is, we go there. It's kind of amazing, isn't it, when you think about it? You know, I'm going to Newport, but somebody asks you what Newport is, and you have to tell them with ultimate analysis, you can't say anything. And then that person is going to say, why are you going there if you don't know where you're going? Yeah. And I remember one time when Circum Rinpoche, many years ago, he was teaching about equalizing and exchanging self with others, and Alex was translating, you know? And Rinpoche was saying, yeah, from this side it's I, and from that side it's you. Yeah. So I. Yeah. And so he said to Alex, you know, what are you? And Alex said, I'm I. And she said, no, you're you. And then Alex says, well, if I'm you, then, you know, I can't be I at the same time. And she said, then you don't really don't know who you are, do you? You know, are you I or are you you? Yeah? It's a good question. And yet we use these words and we understand somehow. Okay. So, you know, Aryadeva's point is that, you know, these things are aren't really so amazing because it applies to everything here. Then 325, the firebrand's ring and magical creations, dreams, illusions, and the moon and water, mists, echoes, mirages, clouds, and worldly existence are alike. So this is showing that the emptiness of true existence is like magical illusions, echoes, dreams, and so forth, okay? So all dependently arising phenomena are like examples. So, you know, if you have a hologram of a really attractive person, yeah, or you have a dream body, you know, you dream that you're somebody and you're going somewhere. None of these things have true existence, yeah, but they still act as causes for erroneous attachment to the self. You see a hologram and that person looks attractive and you go, wow. Or even forget a hologram, look at the TV screen. You see a person in a TV screen, yeah, wow. That guy's so good looking, you know, or whoever it is you're attracted to, yeah? And so even though there is absolutely no person in that TV screen, still it can function to produce a mind of attachment. That's kind of amazing, isn't it, you know? Or like when you're dreaming, you dream of some beautiful thing, you dream of some awful dream thing, so you get full of desire, you get full of fear or anger. There's no object there. Real object. But the dream object, you know, there is a dream object that's kind of illusory, and it can still produce a mind that has an emotional reaction to whatever it is you're dreaming, even though there's no real object there. So in the similar way, even though there's no inherently existent people or objects, they can still function to produce, you know, consciousnesses that perceive them, to produce attachment or anger or ignorance. Yeah, all these things, even though they aren't inherently existent with their own nature, still function to produce results. Yeah. When you really think about it, like, so you go back and forth from the example to what's being exemplified, and you look at that TV screen or computer screen. Now, how in the world can that make me, you know, when you focus on it, you look at the screen, and it's just a screen. How, on the basis of that screen, can I get so emotional? That's ridiculous, isn't it? Yeah? There's no person there. There's nothing happening on the screen. And yet, if I watch the news, I get very emotional. Or if I watch a movie, I react with emotions. But none of that is there. And yet, still, that false appearance can produce emotions. Yeah. So in the same way, even though nothing, people or phenomena, have their own inherent nature, still, because they arise dependently, yeah, they can function to cause emotions or interact with other things and cause things to happen. But it all seems kind of like magic, doesn't it? Yeah? And our mind somehow wants to say, but there has to be some real things there in order for stuff to happen. But there doesn't have to be real things there for stuff to happen. Yeah? There doesn't have to be a findable Newport for us to go to Newport. Yeah? Does that mean that anywhere is Newport? No. Not just anywhere is Newport. Okay. So even the worldly things, you know, the environment and the sentient beings in it are empty, they are still able to function. So the summarizing stanza, and then, oh, if I can borrow somebody's book, I'll read you some verses from the book. The summary stanza from Gelsopje says, thus in the illusory city of the three false worlds, okay, the desire realm, form realm, and formless realm, manipulated by the puppeteer of karmic action, the smell-eater maiden, okay, performs her illusory dance. The smell-eaters are there's some kind of living being that eat just smells, and they live in illusory cities. And some people think that Gandharva is their name. Some people think that that refers to bardo beings, but it's not quite sure. Anyway, the smell-eater maiden performs her illusory dance. Amazing that desire should chase a mirage. Okay, so it's the same way. You see, you know, these guys see a picture of Marilyn Monroe. All it is paper and ink. And desire chases paper and ink. Yeah? It's amazing, isn't it? Okay. So then there's some nice verses here from the King of Concentration Sutra that I'll read to you. In a young girl's dream, she sees a youth arrive. Oh, Prince Charming. Then die. Oh. And feels happy when he arrives, unhappy when he dies. Understand, all phenomena are like this. So even when we meet people, when we're not dreaming, yeah, you go, oh, what a wonderful person. And then they die. Yeah. But there was never a real person there. Yet you were happy when they arrived and sad when they died. But there was never a real person there. Those who conjure illusions create forms of various kinds, horses, elephants, and chariots. They are not at all as they appear. Understand, all phenomena are like this. So magicians who create appearances that look like real objects, but aren't. Yeah. Kind of like holograms. The reflection of the moon shining in the sky appears in a clear pool, yet the moon does not enter the water. Understand, the nature of all phenomena is like that. It looks like there's a moon in the water. There's no moon in the water. Yeah? It looks like, you know, I have a successful life. There's nothing there, you know, only in conventional terms. Echoes arise in dependence upon caves, mountains, forts, and river gorges. Understand, all products are like this. Phenomena are all like illusions and mirages. Okay, so you have an echo of a voice, and it seems so real. Yeah? But all products are like that. They seem real, but they aren't. A person who is tormented by thirst in summer at noon, that transmigrator sees mirages as a body of water. Understand, all phenomena are like this. That's like when we have a very strong emotion, we're tormented by a very strong emotion, then we see a mirage as whatever it is we're craving at that time. You're lonely, then whatever person you meet becomes absolutely wonderful. And you always want to be with them because anybody will do when you're lonely. Yeah, we create people as these kinds of things. Instantaneously, in a cloudless sky, a circle of clouds appear. But try to find from where they came. Understand, all phenomena are like this. You look in the sky, it's clear, and then there's clouds that form. Where did they come from? Your mind's perfectly peaceful, then all of a sudden it's angry. Where did that anger come from? And when it stops, where did it go? Okay. Like mirages and smell-eater cities, like magical illusions and like dreams, objects of meditation are empty of a real entity. Understand, all phenomena are like this. So even your objects of meditation, don't concretize them and make them truly existent. Yeah, like even somebody who has a vision of Tara. Oh, that's really Tara! Are you grasping at inherent existence? Yeah, do you think an inherently existent Tara is appearing to you? Well, she's got to be inherently existent. Otherwise, she's not Tara. But if she is inherently existent, she's also not Tara. Okay. Any questions? Comments? Anything?
The tree. Autumn,
yes.
And there's no sound.
Yeah.
There is sound.
Okay. There is sound. Yeah. But it's not inherently existent sound. It's just called sound. Because if a person were there, a person would hear it. Yeah. But it's not inherently existent sound, because without being heard, it can't be called sound. Yeah? Yeah?
So when you read these verses that you just read, and you get some sense that there really isn't anything here, then when you were saying those, then my mind does that thing at all. There's nothing.
Then there's nothing at all. Yeah.
So how do you move your mind back but don't go...
Yeah. Okay, so you're seeing how when we hear those verses, we go to, then there's nothing existent. Mm-hmm. But then when you really think there's something existent, then how can that thing possibly be empty? Mm-hmm. Here's your bookmark, by the way. So when your mind goes to there's nothing existent, how do you bring it back?
Only a little way.
Because if there were nothing existent, then there would be no cognition of anything. Yeah. So you are cognizing something. You're not cognizing a rabbit's horn.
So I get that. Logically, but I don't get that experience.
Yeah, it's hard to... Yeah, because we're extremists. Yeah. We flip-flop. Yeah? Yeah, because to us, when we see something, then it's inherently existent. Mm-hmm. And then if we negate that inherent existent, then there's absolutely nothing there. But then somebody says, but it is there. Oh, well then it has its own nature and it's that thing. Yeah? We can't see something as empty and as a dependent arising. You know? our minds are too inflexible, ignorant for that. Yeah?
Some comments online, folks are really thinking about this. But one that I thought was interesting was someone said, just like this teaching which I'm viewing on the screen, but it produces an effect, thank goodness.
Okay. So somebody watching online said, just as this teaching I'm viewing on an screen, you know, it's not real people, but it is producing an effect, thank goodness. Yeah, just exactly like that. Yeah?
So I was thinking about it with, you know, basically karma requires objects then to be, you know, dependently arisen.
Right.
Right. So, and then trying to reconcile the idea of, you know, direct perception of emptiness and kind of ending that samsaric cycle and ending that karmic cycle, and how that would relate back to then it still not being independent, inherently existent, emptiness being inherently existent.
Okay, I'm not understanding what your question is.
I'm trying to reconcile that. So, I mean, with the direct perception of emptiness is not inherently existent.
Either, right.
Either.
Yeah.
But, so even beings who have that direct perception of emptiness are still subject then to karma?
Oh, so you're saying emptiness also is empty.
Right.
So does that mean that beings who perceive emptiness are still subject to karma? Because it seems the way you're thinking is that unless things are truly existent...
then they're going to be subject to karma.
Yeah, but nothing is truly existent. Yeah, and karma simply means action. Yeah, so actions are... in samsara anyway, you're created due to afflictions, due to ignorance. Yeah, when you perceive emptiness, then that wisdom consciousness that perceives emptiness can counteract and oppose the mind that's ignorant, that's grasping at true existence. And in that way, stop the arising of afflictions and stop the arising of the polluted karma. Okay, so perceiving emptiness actually cuts your being imprisoned by karma. It doesn't cut it all at once, but it does that slowly. Is that answering your question?
I think
so. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
A question by someone online was, we react from what we impute on the functioning thing. Is that the big problem?
Okay, so it's the problem that we react to what we impute on functioning things. Basically, yeah. You know, on the subtlest level, we impute inherent existence onto functioning things like ourself and objects. And so because we do that, then afflictions arise. Yeah. On a very gross level, we also impute beauty and ugliness on objects. And that very clearly, you know, makes emotions and problems arise. Yeah. And we impute things, you know. Like, I need this. It is so attractive. I need it. I cannot live without it. Yeah. And then our needs become like concrete. Yeah, and I've got to get this, otherwise I can't survive. Whereas if we just relax our mind, then we're okay. Yeah, that's what's so funny about, you know, because we've been doing NVC and we talk about needs and everything. And sometimes we talk about our needs as if they're really concrete. You know, I'm lonely and I need to be with somebody, or I'm you know, I feel disrespected and I need respect. But, you know, as if that's an inherently existent need that's always there. But as soon as you don't pay attention to it, is that need still there? No, it's not manifest in your mind at all. I mean, everybody who has a baby knows all you do is distract the baby and it stops crying, you know? And it works with our baby mind also, because as soon as our mind goes off to another object and stops saying, I need to be with somebody, then we no longer feel that, you know, I've got to be with somebody right now, this very instant, because I'm so lonely and I can't bear it. Yeah? So if that situation were really true, then we would always feel like that. And there would be no way not to be lonely, because we would be inherently lonely. And we would be continually in the state of neediness. Yeah? But our needs are also, our emotional needs are dependent arisings, you know? They're things that, you know, they arise and cease, don't they? They aren't always there.
You know, at one point in the path, can a person attain a realization of subtle impermanence?
At what point? Can, yeah, what, you mean on
you
the...
Do you have a realization of subtle impermanence even before getting on the board or something?
Oh, can somebody have a realization of subtle impermanence before they enter the path? I think so. Either that, or maybe it happens on path of accumulation. But it's, you know, because having a realization of subtle impermanence is not a requirement for entering any of the three paths.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That kind of realization would be so helpful.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Realizing subtle impermanence would be very, very helpful. Yeah. No, just realizing that things are changing momentarily, that nothing exists for a second moment. After it's arisen, it doesn't exist for the next moment. So whatever we're saying, like we say, I need X, whatever X is in that moment, it's going to be different in the next moment. So exactly what is it that we're needing, you know? Because it's not one stable thing. It's changing all the time.
Neither is the need.
Hmm?
Nor is the need itself.
It's, and the need also and itself is changing. Itself, yeah? Yeah?
Is that something that would just be realized through intellectual realization, or is that something that's directly perceived by us?
To realize subtle impermanence, you start with reasoning. There's different ways to realize it. One method, you start with reasoning, and through that way you get a direct perception. Another way is you start with very close mindfulness on objects, watching them change, and through that then you get a direct perception of subtle impermanence.
Is that the same wisdom that's realizing emptiness? It's just
not it's a different wisdom, because it has a different object.
Comment from Venerable Jhampa. Mm-hmm. If we don't see the object as not truly existent, then no attachment will arise, for example, but compassion can tap in.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, because to have anger, you have to have grasping at true existence. To have afflictions, there must be grasping at true existence underlying it. But to have compassion for somebody, there's no such requirement that there be grasping at true existence. Yeah.
It's 4 in the morning for her.
Yeah. She's watching this. Wow. Very good. Okay. Let's This question, this is your question, do I need to do it?
You answered it completely.
I answered it, okay, good.
The question was about how the meaning-making process happens.
Yeah.
All the verses you covered.
Okay, good.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Los Angeles teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Gurana mandala kamniryataya me. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezig, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma, bound by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the west floor.